Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Bark. Everybody have a good fourth? You're thinking about that. Everybody have a good 4th of July? Okay. Everybody come back with all their fingers? All 10? No? Missing a few? Alex, did you come back with the 10 fingers?
And 11 toes.
Okay. Let me see your fingers. Show them to me. Okay, all right. You know, you have an above average number of fingers. Did you know that? It's true. I mean, think about it. It's not rocket surgery. The average number of fingers in the world due to industrial accidents and fireworks mishaps is 9.99998883111. So, you know, around town you might be kind of like this, but if you have all 10 fingers, you're above average. So, let's hear a round of applause for all of you above average people here. Yeah? And without any delay, they're here. You know, there was a DJ in Baton Rouge. When he really liked a record, he would always say, "It's righteous, brightest, and way out of sightest." And he played, this was on the Soul station that I used to listen to. So I would listen to Little Milton and, Jimmy Reed and people like that. And I had these country cousins. And they really loved Elvis. And I would say, "Man," I said, "Elvis is just, y'all are so country. Elvis is just, he's like a dumb hillbilly. He's like y'all, you know." But Elvis, you know, he was that, but he was also a supernatural creature. He was a dumb turd and a supernatural creature, all in one body. That didn't make any sense at all, did it? Anyway, they're righteous, they're righteous, and they're way out of sightious, Zach and Esther.
Good evening and welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. My name is Zach Lindsay.
And I'm Esther.
And we're excited to present Dorothy Chan and Alex Quinlan reading this evening. We're going to get started with the reading shortly, but before we do, I just wanted to review a few simple etiquette guidelines. First, please silence your cell phones and children. Two, please no smoking during the reading. That includes cigarettes, e-cigarettes, and crack cocaine. Three, please wait until between readings or after the reading to get up rather than going to the potty while someone's sharing their poetry. Wait until they're finished. And finally, please no talking while the reading is in session. I think that's it.
So let's welcome Dorothy Chan, who will be introducing our first reader, Alex Quinlan.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here tonight. And thank you, David. Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Esther. Thank you, all of you and the FSU English Department for putting this together. Hi, Alex. So, the first time I met Alex Quinlan 3 years ago, I knew right away that he was someone I needed to have in my life. I immediately sensed his passion for poetry and his deep respect of the written word. I admired his drive in leading a well-curated, innovative literary magazine that is the Southeast Review and what it is today. And never before had I met someone with such an encyclopedic knowledge of literary history. Ask Alex anything about literary history and I swear he's gonna know it. I dare you. We can do it after the reading. And more importantly, he'll go above and beyond in explaining it in the most passionate way, in the most infectious way. And his love for poetry and the written word is not only contagious, but it's also a little scary in the best way possible. Alex Quinlan is one of my favorite people. He's a big brother to me, and I'm fortunate to have spent so many hours working with him in that little Southeast Review office, thinking of all sorts of crazy ideas and talking about our crazy lives. But it's also unfair for me to only talk about our friendship because tonight is also about honoring poetry and I've got a lot to say about Alex's poetry. First of all, Alex is a master of the long poem, which is no easy feat. And to say the very least, I remember attending a reading of his about 2 years ago and feeling so breathless after hearing a long poem he closed with. Alex builds momentum through meditation, and that passion that he exhibits for both the written word and for high and low and middle brow references gets translated into that meditative nature of his poetry. And with that meditation comes nostalgia, a longing that's ineffable, a longing that builds into this larger landscape that's transformed through various passages of time. And I always want to hold on to that longing, but of course I can't because it's also fleeting. I always want to hold on to it and on to it. And I admire Alex's surprising juxtapositions, the way he'll reference a drive on a midsummer morning and bring up both God and Adam of the Sistine Chapel fresco and the music of Clapton, the perfect mix of reference and of high and low. It's beautiful and it's timeless, and Alex is classic. Alex Quinlan's poems and nonfiction have appeared in Bat City Review, Beloit Poetry Journal, Oh No, Pebble Lake Review, Tampa Review, among others, as well as the Tusculum Review, where he has been a contributing editor. He has also performed his poetry as part of Savannah, Georgia-based artist Jerome Meadows' Words and Shadows series. Alex is the former editor of the Southeast Review and earned his PhD at FSU, where he won the Bertram and Ruth Davis Award for Outstanding Career as a graduate student. It is my pleasure to welcome my friend Alex Quinlan.
Just tilt it. Okay, well, I will do my best to live up to that unbelievably generous introduction, Dorothy. Thank you so much. It's been, you know, one of the privileges of my life to have met you and to have worked with you on the Southeast Review and to get to know you as a person and as a poet. It's one of those things that it's inspiring in the sense that it has breathed life into me. So thank you for that. And also, you know, in failing to live up to Dorothy's introduction, I will try to at least live up to this backdrop. And because, I don't know, it's pretty awesome and way more colorful and maybe transporting than some of these words here. But we'll see how it goes. This last year and a half's been pretty rough on everybody, I imagine, right? And of course, this week has been a great just shitstorm to punctuate it, you know, all as the Supreme Court term has come to an end and Anthony Kennedy is retired and life as we know it is just screeching to a halt, right? And it made me think about this poem written by W.S. Merwin in a book of his, The Lice, that was published in 1967, which was the same year that they had the big march on the Pentagon that began, at the Lincoln Memorial and, you know, through the National Mall as a way to try to protest the Vietnam War, and where one of the demonstrators started plugging flowers into the barrels of the National Guardsmen's rifles, right, as they pointed them at the citizens who were peacefully protesting the murder abroad in their names. And it made me, all of these events sort of brought this poem to mind, this poem by Merwin that was published that year called I Live Up Here. And it's almost a satire of what we in our ivory tower might become in a moment like this. And certainly something that makes me lose a little sleep when I think of it. I live up here and a little bit to the left. And I go down only for the accidents. And then, never a moment too soon. Just the same, it's a life, it's plenty. The stairs, the petals, she loves me every time, nothing has changed. Oh, down there, down there. Every time the glass knights lie by their gloves of blood, in the pans of the scales, the helmets brim over with water. It's perfectly fair. The pavements are dealt out the dice. Every moment arrives somewhere. You can hear the hearses getting lost in lungs, their bells stalling. And the silence comes with the plate, and I give what I can, feeling it's worth it. For I see what my votes, the mice, are accomplishing. And I know I'm free. This is how I live. Up here, and simply. Others do otherwise. Maybe. And then I wrote the rest of them that I'm going to read. This is called I Was There. Kissed my thumb, stamped it on your stony forehead while you lay in your steel gray day casket. And since you good as told me what you do and how, since I didn't even answer your last phone call, much less return it, I hopped a train across half of Kansas, all of a moonless Missouri, so I could toss a clod of your grave dirt into the big river, tell it your name, then dive back into the heat shimmer of the brick-paved Delta streets, forging a smile crisp as money, so fresh it hasn't even been spent yet. Behind the wheel of an old Cadillac, I'm gonna fix up when I get the money together. But it's fine for now just to drive around town. Two amber quart bottles sweating through brown paper sacks, Patsy Cline swimming in the radio static, and the dials on the dash and bottle caps flash like dry lightning in the desert you rode off into. Well, that's what I tell myself. But it's only the spark of train wheels, river mist the catfish hover under. And the truth is elsewhere. The truth is the gold tooth staked in the poker game and lost. The truth is the pliers. Marshland. The man nodding off at his kitchen table is just beginning improbably to confuse himself with the angel standing behind him. The angel purses his lips, crosses his arms over his chest, and taps his foot a couple times. The angel asks for a piece of bread. The man kisses his wife on her forehead, and because his lips are made of the radiant dust the bodies of angels are always made of, she doesn't wince. He peels back the onion skin onto which his kitchen and his wife are painted. Behind it is a desert he's seen pictures of. He walks through the desert, walks until his skin takes on the tawny color and parched feel of sand. He walks until his skin becomes the sand, until he can see the ridge of dunes, wind-sculpted, serpent-tracked at the end of the desert, just before it drops off into salt fields. When he reaches the dunes, he walks not over, but into them. Inside, there is a table and a chair. A note has been left. Sit, if that makes you happy. If he were awake, he'd probably wonder if his unhappiness is any more desperate than that of his neighbors and friends. But he would only distract himself from these, his last few moments, in which he'll never suspect his wife has poisoned him with crushed sea mango seeds, that she folded them into a pillowcase and pressed them into powder under the heel of her shoe, that she spent half the morning doing this, the other half making the stew spicy enough to mask the powder's bitterness, all of it for no particular reason, only the general one that she is tired of seeing him look at her without even the slightest flinch of recognition, of seeing him look at everything that way. There's a lot I don't know, don't deserve to know, his name, or if his wife had to walk out to the salt swamps at the edge of town and in the cool, moist center of night, wade out to a cluster of the trees, whether she had to cut the fruit down, if her ankles glistened or the salt traced itself onto her skin. Rolling Thunder. And this is one that requires a little bit of explanation. The title references the bombing mission during the Vietnam War, where they just, you know, cluster bombed the mountains in Laos, because apparently there was some supply lines that they were trying to cut off or something. But caused an enormous displacement of the people who lived there. And one of them became, one of the families displaced by this this event were neighbors of ours when I was growing up. And the little boy's name was Sane. And this is about a day that me and Sane were playing together around our old neighborhood. Rolling Thunder. Stepping around the back of the house, we can hear them in between the billy goat bleats of the alarm on a worn-out car parked over the weekend in the alley behind Mr. Z's speaker world, where two guys are casually hot-wiring a car. It sounds like they're playing music, and their mouths are these great big drums. Sane and me, we glean the brown and green glass bottles from deep in the cricket grass, lob them into the street, tally whether they burst or bounce in chalk on the sidewalk. I'm behind, but I bet my cigarettes I'll rally. Between throws, he tells me his mom doesn't have a last name. We met them earlier that afternoon, standing outside the entrance of Piggly Wiggly. Sane asked me for a quarter to use the phone because his mom didn't trust her English. Dad crammed his hand down the open throat of his jean pocket, gave her next month's rent and a ride home. We must have looked like brothers from the back, on tiptoe, peeking into the window, watching their shadows play on the far wall. All at once, my dad swallowed his mom, and then she swallowed him back. This one just bleeds straight from the title into the lines, so I'll just let it rip. Mornings, those days between apartments and states and schools, going it alone while Dad did his stints in rehab or jail. After she dropped us off at school and Dad off at work in the warehouses, my mom sat on the sun porch of the creaky bungalow Dad would burn down one day, but that day was years away yet. Chain-smoked Virginia Slims, drained silver cans of Diet Coke, and in smooth cursive lines wrote letter after letter at a desk with a 4-inch black and white TV perched at one corner. She wrote the dead, her dad mostly, and the living, mine. When she was done writing, she ripped the pages from the pad and burned them in the backyard grill. I found one once, smoldering still. The top page, somehow preserved as an ashen afterimage at the edges, the text I could still read. I was raped until I breathed. The grimy kid in the Kmart sundress. Her name was Beth, and over by the monkey bars, she said that I was her boyfriend now. Not that I knew what it meant, but it lifted me nonetheless. When we played Life after nap time one day, I landed on Get Married, so I grabbed a blue pen wife to match my blue pen self and the little blue pen car I slid around the board in. But the teacher said I needed a pink one. When I swapped them out, Beth said, "That's me." At recess, I showed a bunch of the boys the pocket knife I snuck from my father's nightstand and smuggled in. Beth kissed my mouth by the sandbox, grabbed me by the wrist, and yanked me back behind the shed where she pulled down my shorts and said her dad's was different. And I'll close with two more, one short and one longer one that my beautiful partner in crime, my wife, Catherine Meeks, asked for me to read. She's back there right now. Everybody give a round of applause to Catherine. She's carrying our second child now, another boy, due November 25th. It's coming fast. Yeah, Sagittarius, also Catherine's birthday and Catherine's sister's birthday, so something weird is going on with that, but we'll check on it. And our first, Galway, is he's 15 months old. This is past his bedtime, otherwise he'd be here. Although, I guess with the rule that you have to keep your kids quiet, he would be promptly ejected. But so here's one kind of turning the corner a little bit. It's called Black Hole. Behind the ballot box curtain was a trompe l'oeil landscape of blue sky flooding, shimmery foil emergency blankets, dank memes. Behind that, a black hole. It was fucked up in stereo, and there may be no way left to reverse this curse. But on my last trip to Goodwill, I stumbled across one of those I Heart You toast stamps your mom branded your breakfasts with when you were small. So I'm bringing lunch to your desk while you write. And I've stamped the grilled cheese because I want to wreck your mind with affection's bas-relief. While out the window, all the pilot waves are out of season and half-starved, beaching themselves, lying on wet sand like barns of the bluest hunger. And this is a longish one that Dorothy actually mentioned in her introduction, and Catherine asked that I read tonight. It's about St. Mark's Refuge. If any of you all have been there, it's just sort of a drive down there and a walk around, and sort of in the style of Robert Haas's book Praise, right? You know, he's just this pleasant guy who just sort of goes out into the woods and thinks his thoughts. And so here we are, called St. Mark's Refuge. Days and weather and roads like these let the heart look elsewhere for its relief. The moss-hung oaks giving way to sawgrass and slash pine. The signs are everywhere. The signs say, ATM inside, atonement, truth, mercy. And it's hot as hell. We have prayer conditioning. They say we don't need more to be thankful for. We need to be more thankful. And my word is my bond, honest transmission work. And honest is a good start, but it's not enough. The signs are everywhere. They say deer have come past. They drank the brown water from this pond. They jumped that fence where the noble arrangement of too many bicycles piled on the trunk rack of the psychologist Taurus collapsed as predicted before the trip has even gotten properly underway. A task accomplished by simply surpassing the city limits and breathing in 100% of the smoke this joint makes as it burns, if that is possible. And if not, that too would be proven in due course on the road to Panacea, which is this coastal town. Have you heard of it? I don't know what your problem is these days, but maybe it will get better if you give the grouper sandwich at Angelo's a shot. Wash it down with a couple bottles of beer and an icy glass. Bass lager if they have it. A beer so good with fish, they named it after one. And if that doesn't work, we can stop at Anita's Funky Emporium on the way back and just talk to her for 5 minutes about the first thing that catches her eye. But we won't be able to leave until we buy something useless and pretty, which would be the most useful way to spend this 20 I found in the dryer. The best way to extend the little squirt of pleasure I felt in finding it. Pleasure is such a difficult concept to understand, but an easy one to feel, thankfully, especially when in the midst of this placid weather unfolding along the what first looked like pine logs scattered on the banks, but reveal themselves at closer range to be alligators. Because nature likes to hide, which is something Heraclitus said when he was hiding out in his cave outside of Ephesus. Nature likes to hide, and we like to hide in it. Brick foundations and rusted evaporation tanks of abandoned sea salt operations lurk in the reeds, and the trails are levees where the alligators basking unaware of the eyes that reach into the ridges on their backs, wondering at their stillness, as did the incredulous northerners at the visitor center who asked whether they were plastic. Their doubts unallayed, though the ranger assured them no one was putting out fakes. No one would believe the real thing when they saw it that way. They are plenty real, though, still, like the bricks of the lighthouse, which was ruined by a storm, then rebuilt with hollow walls. The tides must echo inside it, even if we can't hear it. Just like I can read, even though he isn't saying a word, the mind of the boy beside me, from the expression, wind-battered, beleaguered by longing, as he looks east across a shallow inlet he's thinking of wading across, until his mother tells him about hypothermia and something the wind grabbed, about the state after it, what comes between it and death, paradoxical something. When the mind-body nexus comes so unwound, the one believes the other warm, when they are both freezing. And if it were to come to that, I would go without regrets as soon as I paint your portrait on all the canvas backs paddling the marsh. I don't care what it takes. I will string them up by the webs of their feet, except that you would hate me for it. I would blast the marsh into the shape of your name were it not for the coot whose little bluish hooked bill makes the squawks and hisses of an all-night DJ and is known to some as the river chicken for its want of webbed feet. Its want of pecking at a clump of algae as if it were so much feed corn, while it buzzes around the shallows, bullying the redheads in gangs of three and four, while the tricolor heron ascends above the fray. That kind of placid is a good start on happiness, or something like it. Though it isn't enough, nothing is, or at least not the thing you think. For example, the experts say having children doesn't make you any happier on average than the childless. But tell that to a woman trying to get pregnant, or one who's just given birth. Then again, maybe the heron isn't so stately after all. Look at the way it tucks its neck, the awkward figure it makes. But so what if it's awkward? All birds are, in a way. The very word awkward suggests it. Or that's what I thought. Up until about 5 minutes ago, when I learned the bird is spelled A-U-K. Plus, I had imagined it large and ungainly, a bigger and clumsier version of the pelican, and one whose movements are capable of matching the word they inspire, when I couldn't have been more wrong. It actually comes from Old Norse and means turned the wrong way, which I so often become in the presence of such heady combinations of high frame rate and resolution as these vistas offer. The volume on all the colors turned up to 11. A roar, if one would like to hear, one must be still and listen, even if it turns out the auk is a puffin-like bird that can easily nest in the fountain of one's cupped hands, though it would likely poop. Even if I am deceived by my limited experience into believing the word awkward is as close to ubiquitous as it's ever been, history shows 1897 was actually the most awkward year on record. Or it must have felt that way to a lot of people, judging by how often they used it. And some of them may still be living as I write this, though it is unlikely any of them will remember much about 1897 by now. Even so, I would like to find one of them and ask her, and she will be a woman more than likely, since they live statistically longer than men, and whether they are old or young, tend to be more friendly and open to talking about themselves frankly than their male counterparts, who sometimes have this adding machine that calculates their feelings for them. But even if it does turn out to be a man, I would like to ask, what kept you going all this time? What do you look forward to? What do you look back on? What was the heaviest hurt somebody ever laid on you? And how did you make it through? Did you stay in the city or take to the caves? After all this time, where was it that you found yourself hiding? Thanks, everyone. Please stick around. I'm just the warm-up act. Next up is Dorothy Chan, who I will be directly introducing, I believe. So I'll just roll on ahead with this. Dorothy has some books for sale, so after she knocks you clean out of your shoes with these poems, be sure to stop by this table up here at the front so you can take them home away with you. And I'll be very brief in my words here, but please don't confuse that for a lack of passion for Dorothy and her work. I just want you to get to the good stuff straight away. Dorothy Chan is three times the recommended daily value of everything you need in a poem and want in your life. She doesn't write sonnets, she writes triple sonnets. Where Keats stretched out an encounter with birdsong for 90 lines, Dorothy's odes are full up to and even a little past the brim, riding the surface tension binding baby pandas, Hong Kong, and my grandmother, to take an example. Many prize a poem for its image and think of the eye only. These poems fling open the doors of perception to all the senses, and the result is something that is just a little bit bigger than the universe. And yet, somehow, by dint of their maker's strong and subtle art, made available to us in this one. They aren't merely, as John Ashbery said of his own poetry, the experience of experience. They're the experience of experience elevated. Lend your ears, folks. You are in for a treat. But don't just take it from me. Listen to what our own hosts, David Kirby and Barbara Hamby, have to say about this poem, these poems. Dorothy Chan, says Barbara Hamby, is one scary poet with her in-your-face lust for everything the world has to offer. These poems are by a woman of appetites for food, sex, and the gaudy trappings of the early 21st century. Hong Kong and Vegas are her cities, and she is more than equal to what they are serving up. Her sonnets and odes explode on the page as she explores what it is to be a woman and a daughter in this pornographic moment in time. The poems in her book, Attack of the 50-Foot Centerfold, which again is available right up here at this table. This is a Technicolor debut, Barbara Hamby says. And David Kirby joins that by saying, these poems are steampunk on steroids. They're plutonium-powered and neon-lit. These poems describe the world as it should be, as we want it to be, as we fear it will be, as it is every morning between 3 and 5 when our dreams are invaded by Godzilla, Tarzan, Wonder Woman, King Kong, Sinatra. If Attack of the 50-Foot Centerfold were a holiday, it'd be Halloween for grown-ups, Christmas for space aliens, and the 4th of July for everybody. Because each of these poems is a little present, and like the best presents, they don't just please us. They set us free. Be free. Please welcome Dorothy Chan.
First of all, let's give another round of applause to Alex, please. So I promised all of you that his last long poem would leave you breathless, and I really think it does. So thank you for reading with me tonight, Alex. And it's such a pleasure to be your friend, and I feel so lucky. So everything I'm going to be reading tonight is completely new. And we're going to start off with triple sonnet because you've got that thing going on. Triple sonnet because you've got that thing going on. Asian girls have that thing going on is what the internet search of yellow fever tells me. But no surprises there because have you looked into our eyes? A feline power magnified by a million as you think about the tales of the Orient. But oh, shut up about the spices. Shut up about the dumplings, the temples. Oh, shut up, white boy. who wants a lady on the streets but a freak in the bedroom. And I'll tell you something. I'm a freak everywhere, from elevators to family gatherings, and it's a lot of fun. Kawaii porn, or that fantasy of an innocent face, but oh, that body, the way it moves, and it's a mystique, or the X Factor, or you can't read what's in my black eyes like a shield. And I'll stop talking in superhero terms because, you know, my parents are the real superheroes coming to this country, giving up a penthouse in Hong Kong and a Mercedes and a pay raise and a million other offers you just don't refuse. And those noodle stands and 4 curry fish balls on a stick at midnight. And you can read what's going on in my black eyes because they're like a shield, because that's how I was raised for centuries and centuries and centuries. And you can't beat history and culture. Oh, white boy, I know you can look at me for days, and I know you want to touch me for days. My smooth skin enhanced by Korean beauty products and plain and simple genetics. The way my mother warns me not to blow dry my hair too much, rusting it, making it lose its black shine, and I must wear it black, it never dyed. And white boy, you want to conquer me, and I know that, and I know you love those dumplings so much, and I'd like to see you eat a durian whole, or what about some fish heads and frog legs, and I'm thinking, now that's a cute date. You guys are a very sweet audience. Thank you. Next one. Tied with a rope. Oh, actually, I have a story with this. Where's Barbara? So remember that night I messaged you and you're like, why are you up? And I was like writing these Liberace poems. Yeah, this is one of them. Tied with a rope. When Liberace tells Scott he wants to be his everything in the HBO film that really should have been in theaters, I feel it. The way Liberace wants to be Scott's lover, father, brother, friend, and yes, it's a little twisted, but the best things in life are twisted, like lemons and martinis and the cherub curls of dreamy boy band teen idols and sex positions, and twist a little, why don't you? Stop it with the lazy sideways, though it's relaxing and tender and hold me now. And America, why are you afraid of anything that's too gay? And I think of Scott coming out of the pool, the statues of Adonis's behind him, and he's hungry for a burrito. And can you imagine two beautiful women rising out of the pool like goddesses out of water? And I think of this as I'm watching two gorgeous women in a martini glass kiss in a Vegas show. And I think of this as I'm watching reruns of that reality fashion show where the challenge is for the designers to dress their models, making a splash. And would you go all goddess? She's high society, Grace Kelly, white bikini, white caftan, or black in bondage, tie me up with a rope, and I like getting tied up, handcuffed even, a little kink never hurt anyone. And don't you love lemon twists in your martinis and orange twists in your scotch? And when Liberace tells Scott he wants to be his everything in the HBO film that really should have been in theaters, but America's too afraid of anything that's gay, I think about what it's like to be someone's beloved. And how everyone wants to claim somebody. But why? And I'm sure, and sure, I'll wear a sparkly choker in the bedroom, but don't you dare give me a leash in real life, like how couples in Japan and Korea wear matching outfits, because how else are you going to tell the world that you're a couple if you're not dressed in matching hats, matching shirts, matching pants, matching bags, matching shoes, and no thank you. Shopping is a one-woman sport. And I can't want you if you're dressed like me. And yes, it's cute. The stuff of after-school specials and picking the marshmallows out of your cereal, but not for me. And I'd rather be a devil girl from Mars who's just led on Earth, ready to wreak havoc in the center of the universe, be a freak in the bedroom and a king everywhere else, and a king everywhere else with an orange twist in my scotch, a lemon twist in my martini, and a little twisting and turning in every single room. Go a little nuts, let down my hair, take off my bra, eat some cherries and whipped cream. And when Liberace tells Scott he wants to be his everything in the HBO film that really should have been in theaters, but why, America, why? I really do believe it, and I want to believe it, because the best things in life are a hell of a lot twisted and weird. And who doesn't want to wake up to cherubs on the ceiling, a bowl of cherries and whipped cream with a lover on the side? Ode to lasagna.
A friend tells me his favorite word is lasagna, and all I can think about is my favorite word, sashimi. And yes, it's near lunchtime, but there's something about the S that gets me every time, and I love toro and unagi and mackerel and salmon roe. Give me that tingling in my mouth once the roe boss popped. Sashimi. The rise and fall, the rise and fall, the serpentine motion of S. S.A. Sa, how sexy is my shirashi, like the hot older sister of sashimi, partying it up in the club, a little nip slip out of the tight white crop top cami that reads, I will destroy you, serving me steam, sex. A little vodka mixed with pineapple and seltzer. And now give me serpentine, like Aang's La Grande Odalisque, and how gorgeous is she? The butt, the peacock feathers brushing, and when I think serpentine, I also think contrapposto, and how the right man pulls off contrapposto, and the right woman pulls off serpentine, and back to the odalisque, just look at her back that keeps curving, her face that does more than launch 1,000 ships. It dares you to join her in this oil on canvas, and she's telling you, will you use these peacock feathers to brush up against my leg, my thigh? Tickle me and tease. Give me something a little bit more tonight behind this curtain. And I guess lasagna isn't that bad of a word, but really it's no sashimi that rolls off the tongue, slippery when wet, slippery always for you. And when I hear lasagna, I think of Garfield chowing down on his favorite entree like there's no tomorrow in the middle of the Sunday funnies. And of course, Garfield's babe of a girlfriend, Arlene of the long neck, the pink for her lips that opened into her gap tooth, supermodel of the cartoon world smile. And once at a bar, my best friend pointed out that a boy stood closer to me just because I was wearing pink. And does that make us all softies at heart? Give me steam, give me sex, give me serpentine. Say something to me so I won't stop staring at your lips. So this next poem was inspired by Chanel's 2014 runway show, and the one in Paris, where Karl Lagerfeld had this a brilliant idea of having the models walk through a supermarket. So it was very Stepford Wives, but very, very Parisian. Come into my grocery store fantasy and I wear Chanel. A Russian architect takes me on a date to the supermarket, which is either dreamy and creative or just plain weird. And I keep thinking back to Chanel's fall 2014 runway show. It's a fashion supermarket in the middle of Grand Palais, Paris, where all your Cinderella dreams come true in pink tweed and sneakers, and in a grocery store that sells designer pasta and pâté and jambon and fromage, the two words everyone remembers from elementary French. And isn't Paris the best place to fall in love in the world, even if it's in the middle of a grocery store? And no, I don't really mean what I'm saying here, because as we've learned from The Bachelor, you can fall in love here, you can fall in love there, you can fall in love anywhere, like we're living in a goddamn children's book. And if you ask me, I'd much prefer taking that leap in Vegas, because if romance itself is tacky, we might as well seal the deal in the middle of a nightclub over flaming margaritas and pineapple tiki drinks, or during a drag performance when Savannah Smiles, our hostess, brings up a couple on stage to sit on a bed as the audience watches. As the audience watches, and it's embarrassing for them, as I mount a pole, putting on a pair of clear pink stripper platforms and a G-string, as you stuff a $100 bill in my ass with my consent. But honestly, I'd probably fall off, and I'd much rather have all this madness than a sweeping declaration of love, which is why yes and done and won are the greatest words in the English language. And if you're the man, just look at me the right way, and I know, and if fashion girls in 2014 are dressing like Stepford Wives going to the gym, stuffing their shopping carts with lime green and lemon yellow coats, and Lanvin de Chanel eggs, and Chanel tweed bubble, and orange and tropical soda, and Chanel Paris Dallas ketchup, then you and I can have our own updated fairy tale fantasy that begins in the supermarket. Do you want ramen or Korean spicy rice cakes for dinner, or what about bibimbap or hot pot with lots of roast beef, because the fantasy island of strip clubs and pink fizzy cocktails and Chanel miniskirts is great, but I'd like real life with you, and all I need is a one-word answer, nothing else. Drop $65,000 on Gucci handcuffs, make me happy. Drop $65,000 on Gucci handcuffs, make me happy. For my birthday, I'd like a pair of Gucci handcuffs from the 90s Tom Ford era of kink. And yes, I'm a small Asian girl, but let me have my fun too in this world of tiger moms and tiger dads, or in my case, rabbit moms and tiger dads. Be a little naughty, but not naughty like the four-year-old girl I was in Hong Kong a long time ago, standing up in the middle of class fetching my crackers mid-lecture. And thank the Lord my dad was friends with the principal of the school, and I was such a bad girl. And now give me kink, because if you're a man, you can handle a little pink and fuzzy, or straight up savage. For $65,000, here's a sex toy, complete with a story of a hitman and fashion family rivals. Let me cuff you. Let me cuff your big, strong hands, strong enough to lift me from a chair in the middle of the night when I'm cold outside and I want you. I want your voice. I want the way you look at me when I ask you if we should close the blinds in the hotel room and the view. Did you ever think people watching us? Do you ever think about people watching us? Or what about that Playboy shoot, her bare butt facing up? Her bunny eyes looking out into the jungle that is LA. And she will conquer all, eat all, and imagine the snake of Eden sucking on Eve's nipple, or if you prefer something tamer. Think Cronach the Elders, tiny snake popping out that tree, or what about his three graces? And a teacher taught me back then, artists use the same model for all three women, and don't you see that red mark on the one grace's bare ass? The model's tired, and watch her, want her. Watch her, want her, reach into the painting. And aren't we all voyeurs in life, the stuff of nightmares? Your snake and me, or take Toshio Saiki's prints, the beautiful woman slicing her breasts like bologna as the man sucks on her nipple, the other woman behind the divider. And have you heard of the OC, the orange curtain? Or as one porn star once said, I'd rather be on this side of the curtain than the other side. And if there's anything more glorious in life to behold than a woman's breasts in California, and be at her mercy when she cuffs you with those $65,000 Gucci silver babies. And you know you're having fun. Today's her birthday, and she's only getting started. So I've been having a lot of fun with this triple sonnet form, because I like to think of the sonnet, the 14-line poem in pentameter, as the amuse-bouche, or the appetizer, poetry. And the thing about appetizers is, unlike entrees, or sometimes maybe entrees, but appetizers, you always want more. And three's a lucky number, so why not keep going with three? Triple sonnet for Asian girls eating gelato. My parents want me to marry a nice Chinese boy, and I just want to be pushed against the wall outside the gallery of a five-star hotel. And oh, what a compromising position in black winged liner and red glossed up lips. And who doesn't think kissing is the greatest thing in the world other than eating? Or maybe it's the other way around. And sure, I'll settle for the lobster Wellington and rosemary potatoes after the sex. And really, whatever happened to raw appeal and romance novel passion? And put me on the cover now, breasts exposed, a hand reaching down my blouse, the stuff of dreams, of middle of the night cravings. Like when I look at Place of Gelato, those beautiful messes of biscotti thrown into marzipan Italian ice cream, and those beautiful messes of strawberry drizzled onto strawberry cream. And yes, a little messy is always a good thing. It's a whole lot of good. Like getting lipstick all over a guy's face, the way chocolates are named after public displays of affection. And my parents want me to marry a nice Chinese boy, but what's the fun in arrangement? And sometimes I do wonder if there's a hidden guy for me somewhere in Hong Kong. My parents are waiting to debut a family dinner, and that thought's really scary. Where's the passion? Where's the pirate wrench book cover? Where's the middle of the night fridge rays of ice cubes on his chest and honey on your knees feeding each other Luxardo's cherries? And it's sexy when things are a surprise, a present, a lavender macaroon wrapped up in a tiny box, or the way a lover smiles oh so tenderly after the act as you wonder. And it's sexy when things are a surprise, like learning each other's favorite foods or fantasizing in bed about what you'll both eat next, the spicy ramen and rare burgers, and oh, those messy piles of gelato mixed with soft kisses. Never stop feeding me, baby. I'm hungry already. So with that gelato imagery, there is this Instagram account that you shall follow with that imagery, but I don't remember it right now, but I'll show it to you after the reading. Okay, this one, every time I do a reading, I like to write a poem either the night before or a couple hours before so that it's like it's in me. So this is the one for tonight. It's called Asian Girls from Mars Go Everywhere. A supermodel holds a clutch that reads good girl down the runway. And I think, wow, way to put a label on yourself, because are women either good girls on Earth or bad girls from Mars who'll take you places beyond and beyond and beyond? And you might have heard that women are from Venus and men are from Mars, but that story's old, because I don't want to talk about my problems. I want to find solutions. And I hate walks on the beach and couples night and couples booths and couples specials. And all I want for Valentine's Day is always sex and lobster and skip the chocolate and roses, or actually, I'll take a box of Godiva, the 36-piece box with a baby blue ribbon only. A woman always knows exactly what she wants, and have you heard that girls on Earth are really nice, which should be the title of a porno mocking 70s porn, and maybe there's cheerleaders and tight sweaters and rah, 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 and shower scenes and a Charlie's Angels-esque slow-mo montage, but the point is, these women aren't looking for love, and aliens land on Earth, America of all places. And these aliens, well, they know about art and fine cheese and wine and the right way to cut fresh fish for some fresh sashimi. And the women are charmed, oh so charmed. And maybe they're bad girls because they want to go places, and I want to go places too, like cities you only see in film. The way the sky is purple in Japanese animation. Or what about those beautiful towns with those beautiful bakeries of melon bread and chestnut cake and strawberry hearts with piles and piles of cream? And what about neon pink cities with those skylines? And maybe I'm a bad girl because I want to go places, and I think about that clutch walking down the Milan runway, good girl. How Asian girls, well, we've got that thing going on, and the world sees us as these good girls with our round heads and innocent eyes, oh so kawaii, and yes, daddy, yes. Or take the way girls in anime flash their panties to show a little innocence, show a little oops, I really didn't mean to, and we all know that they know what they're doing. And isn't it beautiful when you can play a little trick on the world, flash your panties, strip a man of his everything? And if good girls hold white clutches and stay on Earth, then I want to go to Mars, which should be the title not of a porno, but a real life film, because don't you want piles and piles of fluffy cakes with fluffy centers and never-ending fruit on top and strawberry filling and the fattiest of all fatty tuna sashimi? And you can eat and eat and eat and dress and undress yourself in front of a million mirrors in a castle on a cliff that floats in the sky while the clouds change colors. And oh, why can't we just leave this Earth, buy a rocket ticket to Mars? So this one is about my childhood in Hong Kong, where I was a really, really bad kid. It's called, it's about the first teacher I ever had, and the day, I still remember. So I was on the playground one day, and I got in trouble because I shared my Fruit Loops with another kid. And in America, that's a nice thing. I don't know why it's not in Hong Kong, but I got in trouble that day. And then my teacher, Mrs. Guan, she pointed at the sky because there was like an airplane flying by, and she knew I was going to America real soon, and she pointed, and she's like, oh, you're going to be up there real soon. I'm so happy. So this is called, yeah, thank God my dad was friends with, like, the person who, like, administered the school. So this is called, Where Are All the Hot Pilots? Thank you, Mrs. Guan. I'm 4 years old, and a plane's flying above the Hong Kong playground when my teacher, Mrs. Swan, well, Mrs. Guan, but I always think of her as a swan, also known as the creature I fear the most in life, because have you seen swans bully ducks at the zoo or chase brides down the lake eating their Vera Wang? And MTV captures that moment, and I can't switch the channel fast enough, and maybe I've taken too many Renaissance art history classes. Zeus as glitter, Zeus as a swan, wrapping his neck around Leda's Rubenesque figure, like Bjork's 73rd Academy Awards evening wear. Zach, that's for you. A beak that's ready to open, ready to feast, and Mrs. Guan's now beaming, pointing to the sky. You're going to be on that plane soon to America. And she must have been so relieved the way I'd stand up in the middle of class and stretch and eat crackers, or write my name in Chinese too large, or 4-year-old date the only European European boy in school, and I remember his name, Anton, Anton, Anton. And maybe I was the creature Mrs. Guan feared the most in life, the little girl who wreaked havoc in the Hong Kong classroom. And Mrs. Guan, thank you for giving me my love of airports, which beats that Swarovski swan I gifted you the day before I moved to Pennsylvania. And thank you for the afternoon you pointed at the sky, because I knew just then at 4 I needed to escape. But airports aren't just about departures and destinations to Hawaii over the sunset like a tanning lotion ad. They're also about arrivals, reminding me of that short-lived 80s-style dramedy featuring the woman who booked JFK Airport as her wedding venue, flights canceled and delayed, and the unlimited energy and time and money, and yes, that's excessive, and home sweet home is wherever I'm with the one I love, or home sweet home, the ceramic pineapple engraving my parents have hanging in their Vegas home, and yes, Manhattans and double wild turkeys and dirty martinis at airports are overpriced, but the more important question remains, why aren't there any hot pilots anymore? As damn it, I want my Vivian Leigh Waterloo Bridge moment of cat eye fucking every hot guy in sight in uniform, but my version's in the airport, not the train station, and there's no ill-fated roses since I don't even like flowers. And Mrs. Guan, I'm sure you miss me, and I sure do miss you. And every time a plane takes off, I'll think of my glass swan on your bookshelf shattering, and I'm just going to get out of here, take my crackers with me, stand up in the middle of class. Boy, I really hope this airport has some hot pilots. Thank you. Triple sonnet for the girl with 10 stomachs for Barbara and David. And at this time, I would like to thank my mentors, the best mentors I could possibly ask for, Barbara Hamby and David Kirby. A round of applause for them and everything that they do for their students and their mentees. Triple sonnet for the girl with 10 stomachs. Did any of you see that? I think it's a Pixar short with the bow. Do you guys see that? Yeah. It's funny that people don't get it, but... No surprise, but it's okay. This is for us and Barbara and David. I want a large bao stuffed with leftovers available at an old school Hong Kong dim sum restaurant with bird cages hanging in homage to yesteryear, the 1950s Hong Kong my mother tells me about as her sesame gelatin and sesame rolls arrive, a slice of that divine Chinese sponge cake, ha gao, and sticky rice and lotus leaf. Carts towed around with treasures of mango pudding and egg tarts. And I'm still hung up on those bird cages. And oh, those birds who once upon a time sang songs while patrons sipped on tea reading newspapers all day in this musical of birds and musical of food. And in this musical of food in the middle of this restaurant in Central, I'll be playing the girl with 10 stomachs. Because I swear every time I fly to Asia, I grow 9 extras, each one compartmentalized for a different food group. And you know I'll need at least 3 stomachs for desserts, the dango and gelatin and ice cream glasses in Japan, the mango ice and mochi and green tea creme brulee. And all I want to do is eat and eat and eat and eat. And we all build our own fantasies. Foie gras at a French restaurant in D.C., extra fat and some mussels and clams, and damn, we forgot to order steak and fries again. And when it's time for dessert, the poached peaches and pears, I ask my friend Misha if she's got room, and she tells me, of course, it goes in a different compartment. And I think she's brilliant, making me think of Japanese animation when monsters hide their second stomachs under black cloaks and cutting a piece of the moistest sponge cake in the world. I feel that fluffiness devoured in the creature's second stomach, teeth and tongue staring through the cloak, and oh, cut that cake again. Why does food look so good in anime? The bacon you can chew on forever, the eggs in a basket, the ramen, butterflies in my stomach unleashed. Oh, cut that cake again. And I'm going to close with an ode. Ode to sexiness. Ode to sexiness. When I was a little girl, I'd fantasize about being a mermaid in a nightclub, which is actually an odd job I read about in Reader's Digest, along with fortune cookie writer and dog walker and tissue box designer. And growing up, my parents subscribed because that was the American dream. The English version arriving in the mail from my mother, the Chinese version from my father, so I guess my dream involved being a sexy grown-ass woman, divine goddess trapped in a tank, swimming around luxuriously, able to hold my breath underwater for an endless amount of time, and damn, wouldn't that be such a nice gift? And now I'm picturing this scene in the highest bar in Hong Kong, Ozone, at the Ritz-Carlton, and I wonder why they just don't put a tank in there, because I like being on the top of the world, center of the universe, woman. Woman splashing around in the tank in a seashell bikini, and yes, that's on trend right now, but I'd like actual seashells because a challenge is always good. As international businessmen are served Mongkok coolers, bamboo vodka infused, sushi rice, blackberry, lime, hibiscus syrup, basil, yuzu foam, and I'd love to get out of that tank, boss those men around, water dripping out over the floor of this fancy bar, eat a few pieces of calamari off their plate. And why? Why does one of my fantasies even involve being locked up to begin with? And I do love dancing in bird cages and nightclubs and grinding on men who are easier to manipulate than women. The fairer sex locked up is the fantasy of the box, but then you want what you can't have. You want what you can't have. You want escape. Love me, spank me with a black ruler with gold tassel that reads La Leçon, also known as a Eugene Ionesco play. And don't we live in such an absurd world? And tell me that I'm hard to read. Tell me that I'm hard to read because it's frustrating. I'm frustrating, but you've got to know that a challenge can be so goddamn sexy. And did I ever tell you that I was born in the year of the snake? And I feast on men born in the year of the rat. And I can show you how to eat a banana elegantly with a knife and fork, and how to eat a raw oyster elegantly with a knife and fork, filed all under useless skills, until we're meeting the queen and her corgis. And yes, thank me later. Thank me, or better yet, let's install a tank right there in the highest bar in Hong Kong. And I was wondering, how many minutes can you hold your breath underwater? Thank you.
Let's give both of our readers another hand.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Please be reminded to bring your glasses to the bins over by the door and to tip your bartenders heavily. Also, we have these sexy books for sale up here. Attack of the 50-Foot Centerfold, each hand printed at Spork Press. So come up and get you a copy while you can before they all disappear. We will see you next week for Desiree Ame and Zach Gerbrick. Thank you again for coming.